He reports that a growing number of doctors believe that inflammation is the source of a wide range of conditions, including dementia, depression, autism, ADHD, and even aging. It is no longer enough to eliminate fats and cholesterol from one's diet. An anti-inflammatory diet excludes processed foods, dairy products, and commonly, meat. While such a diet may lead to weight loss, which can be a good thing, there is no hard evidence that it curbs inflammatory disorders or does anything else to tame the behavior of macrophages. One approach to the apparent unpredictability of macrophages is to abandon the category of macrophages and postulate that there are several subcategories of cells doing the various things we attribute to them. Supposedly, each category of macrophages has its own set of genetic instructions, which it obediently follows. For a while, the favored division was between M1 macrophages, which are responsible for killing microbes, and those of the M2 variety, which focus on wound healing. But this classification does not account for the fact that the M2 designation encompasses cells with dramatic differences in their biochemistry and physiology. Or, as one frustrated team of researchers put it, instead of having a finite number of variants that can be easily counted, we have an infinite number of polarized activated macrophages. A common response has been to double down on the functional classification of macrophages, as a 2008 article proposes. We suggest that a more informative foundation for macrophage classification should be based on the fundamental macrophage functions that are involved in maintaining homeostasis, a state of balance supposedly necessary for the health of the organism. We propose three such functions: host defense, wound healing, and immune regulation. But what about macrophages' role in abetting cancer, or in instigating life-threatening inflammatory diseases? What functions do these activities represent? As it turns out, the macrophages that launch tumor cells into the bloodstream do not seem to fit either canonical category M1 or M2, suggesting that we should be focusing less on static categories than on the mutability of individual macrophages. Maybe, crazy as it sounds, they are not following any kind of instructions, but doing what they feel like doing. Chapter 9. Tiny Minds. Well before the 20th century triumph of the molecular biologists, the whole field of immunology had begun with the close observation of individual macrophages. Observation is usually the job of naturalists, who crouch patiently in the bushes to study, for example, the behavior of wild animals. Laboratory scientists are more prone to aggressive interventions, which might involve chopping up the animals' brains and studying their biochemical composition. Fortunately, the father of cellular biology had both the patience of a naturalist and the intellectual impatience of an ambitious lab researcher. The brilliant and obsessive Russian zoologist Ilya Metchnikoff, who was described in Paul de Kruijff's 1926 book Microbe Hunters as being like some hysterical character out of one of Dostoevsky's novels, had been attracted to macrophages while studying flatworms and sponges. Macrophages are eye-catching enough, large cells capable of moving among other body cells, and as he was the first to discover, they had an even better trick. They could ingest particles, such as microbes, by enfolding them and exposing them to powerful digestive enzymes, the process that Metchnikoff named phagocytosis. The question was how the macrophages knew what to attack and what to leave alone, which cells or particles were normal, and which were deserving of destruction. Metchnikoff's answer was essentially that macrophages, enjoying the most independence of any body cells, could decide this on their own, protecting cells they recognized as belonging to the self and devouring anything else. This explanation was instantly rejected by most of Metchnikoff's contemporaries. As philosopher Alfred Tauber writes, the phagocyte, macrophage, as possessor of its own destiny and mediator of the organism's selfhood, was received as too vitalistic a conception, meaning that it was almost mystical. How could a microscopic cell make decisions? On the one hand, it was too small and, of course, utterly lacking anything resembling a nervous system. On the other hand, it was too large, at least compared to the individual molecules increasingly favored by 20th century molecular biologists as the arbiters of everything that goes on in the body. And what is a cell anyway, except a collection of proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and other chemicals enclosed in a lipid-based membrane? When, during a phone interview in 2016, I asked Alberto Mantovani, one of the early researchers on the role of macrophages in tumor development, what he thought of the growing interest in cellular decision-making, he asked me to repeat the phrase. Then he guffawed. But there it is. A little over a century after Metchnikoff's dismissal for the scientific crime of vitalism, the forbidden phrase began to gain respectability. I say a little over a century because I cannot locate its first appearance in the scientific literature. By 2005, the term cellular decision-making, without the quotation marks, was showing up in the titles of articles. 5 years later, it was the subject of international conferences. Why Mantovani was unaware of it, I do not know and was perhaps too polite to ask. I will admit, though, that even to me the notion still carries a whiff of whimsy. Officially, cellular decision-making is the process whereby cells assume different, functionally important, and heritable fates without an associated genetic or environmental difference. One translation would be a process that we do not understand and cannot predict. For mobile cells like macrophages and amoebae, one of the most common decisions is about where to go next, and here we humans can only make large generalizations, such as that they will move toward edible or otherwise attractive material. But this is a very general observation. New techniques, like intravital microscopy, have made it possible to track the behavior of individual cells in living tissue, and the resulting images reveal striking degrees of individuality. If you calculate the bulk average of movements within a sample group of cells, most cells turn out to be going their own way, on paths far from the average. Cancer cells within a tumor exhibit extreme diversity. NK, or natural killer cells, which, like macrophages, attack targets like microbes, do not always kill. A 2013 article reports that about half of the NK cells sit out the fight, leaving a minority of them to become what their human observers call serial killers. Another type of immune cell, the T cells or thymus-derived lymphocytes that are attacked by the HIV virus, are especially frustrating to observers because they move about by a series of repetitive lunges, repeatedly balling up and then extending. This cycle appears to be driven by an intrinsic rhythmicity, with a period of about 2 minutes. T-cells travel in a fairly consistent direction during each lunge and may even continue in a consistent direction over several cycles. However, following each pause, there is a high probability that a cell will take off in another direction. The fact that something is not completely predictable does not mean that it is unexplainable. As one explanation for cellular motion, scientists offer a stochastic noise, meaning that cells are being randomly jostled by other cells, or particles in the extracellular fluid. In any fluid or gas, the molecules are in motion at speeds determined by the temperature. Sometimes they collide with each other and rebound in new directions, which can create the impression of self-determined motion. The other type of explanation is that some of the particles or molecules colliding with cells are not entirely random, because they contain information encoded as chemical messages. For example, macrophages and other immune cells use small proteins called cytokines to summon others of their kind for help at a site of inflammation. So a determined determinist might say, cells are not deciding what to do, they are being told what to do. But the experiences of being randomly jostled and, perhaps at the same time, receiving intelligible messages are also common to the only creatures who insist on possessing free will, ourselves. While walking on a sidewalk, I may collide, apparently randomly, with other pedestrians, and in ways that cause me to walk closer to or farther from the curb. At the same time, I may be receiving text messages on my phone, advising me to hurry up or to not forget to pick up some groceries. All of this incoming data, the crowded sidewalk, the shopping list, must be processed by my mind before I can decide on the best direction and speed at which to walk. There may be additional factors that would make me alter my path. If, for example, I am trying to avoid someone else in the crowd, I might suddenly speed up and slip around a corner. The differences between a human being negotiating a busy sidewalk and a single cell are, of course, almost unfathomably large. A cell is a cell. A human is composed of trillions of cells, enough so that a trillion or so can be dedicated to collecting and parsing information from the environment. But second by second, both the individual cell and the conglomeration of cells we call a human are doing the same thing, processing incoming data and making decisions. I learned an important lesson in non-human decision-making from my own crude informal form of bird-watching. While living on the Gulf side of the lower Florida Keys, I became intrigued by the group behavior of ibises. As the sun set, they would flock to a nearby mangrove island to roost for the night. Sometime around sunrise, they would take off again for their feeding grounds. I assumed that both events were driven by the angle and intensity of the sunlight, or perhaps by some ibis leaders or central committee. How else would the birds know what to do? But further observations revealed that the morning liftoff could be the coordinated action of up to 100 birds at a time, or it could be messy and anarchic, with individuals and small groups taking off at slightly different times. When I asked an animal behaviorist, an old friend at Cornell, what was controlling their behavior, he did not rule out the effect of the sun or the possible existence of trendsetters among the ibises, but suggested that there was a lot of early morning jostling and nudging. In other words, nothing was controlling them in the determinist sense I was looking for. No on-off switch telling the birds to stay put or get up and forage. Inadvertently, I had stumbled across what has been called the Harvard Law of Animal Behavior, which is related to Murphy's Law. You can have the most beautifully designed experiment with the most carefully controlled variables, and the animal will do what it damn well pleases. It had not occurred to me with my Ph.D. in cell biology that a truly bird-brained creature like an ibis could be making any decisions at all, either individually or collectively, just as it had not occurred to me that the actions of individual cells were not fully determined by the cell's environments and genes. But much smaller biological entities than bird brains have been credited with decision-making. In 2007, a German team discovered what they called free will among, of all things, fruit flies. The flies were immobilized by tethering them and gluing them to the inside of an all-white drum that offered no sensory clues. Still, the tormented flies struggled desperately to fly, with the humans all the while recording their motions and subjecting them to a variety of mathematical analyses. The result was that the flies' motions were not random, as mathematically defined. They were spontaneous, and originated in the insects themselves. And why would a fruit fly want to generate non-random but completely unpredictable patterns of motion? According to Bjorn Brems, the leader of the team, unpredictability could confer a survival advantage, a more deterministically designed type of creature. Say, one that always moves to the right when alarmed, would be far more susceptible to predators. One criticism Brems reported from a neurobiologist colleague was that fruit flies are simply too small to engage in decision-making, much less anything as exalted as free will. But they are far from the smallest specks of living or lifelike material to exhibit autonomous behavior. Perhaps one of the examples best known to biologists is the phage lambda, a virus that preys on that familiar resident of our guts, the bacterium E. coli. A virus is a strand or two of nucleic acid, usually DNA, coated with protein, visible only through an electron microscope, yet in the course of their development phage have a crucial choice to make. When one of them penetrates an E. coli cell, it can either remain there in a state of dormancy, passively reproducing its nucleic acid when the cell divides, or it can immediately lyse the cell, splitting it open and releasing a swarm of progeny to invade other E. coli. Acres of paper have been filled with differential equations in an effort to predict which way an encounter between phage and E. coli will go, with the result that the outcome seems to depend on decision-making by individual phage. As we proceed down the scale, from cells to molecules, and from molecules to atoms and subatomic particles, the level of spontaneity only increases until we reach the wild dance party that goes on at the quantum level. Quantum physics has shown that the behavior of subatomic particles is inherently unpredictable. For example, when a beam of electrons is passed through a pair of slits, each electron gets to choose which one to enter. It is impossible, in the case of an atom or subatomic particle, to simultaneously know where it is and how fast it is going. As the renowned physicist Freeman Dyson has put it, there is a certain kind of freedom that atoms have to jump around, and they seem to choose entirely on their own without any input from the outside, so in a certain sense, atoms have free will. Such statements come with an implicit disclaimer. No one is implying that cells or viruses or subatomic particles possess consciousness, desires, or personalities. What they possess is agency, or the ability to initiate an action. If even that seems like a reckless statement, it is because we are so unused to thinking of agency as an attribute of anything other than humans, or God, or perhaps some of the larger charismatic animals, like elephants or whales. I am using the word in the generous philosophical sense employed by Jessica Riskin in her brilliant book, The Restless Clock, as something like consciousness, but more basic, more rudimentary, a primitive prerequisite quality. A thing cannot be conscious without having agency, but it can have agency without being conscious. Agency, she goes on, is simply an intrinsic capacity to act in the world, to do things in a way that is neither predetermined nor random. We routinely and colloquially ascribe agency to things we know are not conscious or even alive, as in, this car just doesn't want to start, fully realizing that the car doesn't want anything. Riskin's point is that the mission of science, the determinist science that arose in the middle of the 17th century, has been the elimination of the last vestiges of agency from the natural world. Lightning, we are told, is an electrical charge, not an expression of divine displeasure. The amoeba does not move because it wants to, but because it is driven by chemical gradients in its environment. Tell a scientifically trained person that something is unpredictable, and she will do her best to find a way to predict and control it. But agency is not concentrated in humans or their gods or favorite animals. It is dispersed throughout the universe, right down to the smallest imaginable scale. Science has an answer to Riskin's thesis. According to the latest from the field of cognitive science, humans have an innate tendency to see agency, whether in the form of gods or spirits, where it does not exist, because there was once a survival advantage in doing so. A prehistoric person or hominid would be wise to imagine that every stirring in the tall grass meant that a leopard, or some such potentially hazardous life form, was closing in for an attack. If you decide the stirring is a leopard, you can run away, and if you were wrong, nothing is lost except perhaps some temporary peace of mind. But if you decide that it is just a breeze and it turns out to be a leopard, you become a leopard's lunch. So our brains evolve to favor the scarier alternative and the choice of running. We have become what the cognitive scientists call hyperactive agency detection devices. We see faces in clouds, hear denunciations in thunder, and sense conscious beings all around us, even when there is nothing there. This has become a key part of the scientific argument against religion, and one of the best-known books on the subject is entitled, Why Would Anyone Believe in God? If it seems a rather precipitous leap from imagined leopards to monotheistic deities, this may be because the cognitive scientists made it too quickly. The point is not that many of the leopards turned out not to be there, but that in the world occupied by hominids and early humans, they often were. Quite possibly many of our ancestors knew full well they were erring on the side of caution and made the error anyway, which is a choice we can understand. What may be harder for us to understand today is that we evolved on a planet densely occupied by other agents, animals that could destroy us with the slash of a claw or the splash of a fin, arbitrarily and in seconds. The hypothesized transition from suspected predators to the morally ambiguous spirits believed in by early humans makes more sense when we recall that, before humans could hunt for themselves, they seem to have relied on the bones and scraps of meat left by non-human predators. That is, the predator was also a provider, more or less like the gods that came later. The scientific argument, in other words, is that the attribution of agency to the natural world was a mistake, although a useful one in an evolutionary sense. I am suggesting, to the contrary, that it was the notion of nature as a passive, ultimately inert mechanism that was the mistake, and perhaps the biggest one that humans ever made. The death of nature, as Carolyn Merchant put it, turned the natural world from a companionable, though often threatening place, into a resource to be exploited. Determined to reduce biology to chemistry, 20th century biologists tended to skip right over life at the cellular level. Molecules were much more manageable and far more predictable than living cells. In doing so, though, biology generated paradoxes and mysteries, like the problem of immune cells that abet cancer or foment autoimmune diseases. Through the lens of reductionist science, even life itself became a kind of mystery, resolvable only as an incredibly complex concatenation of molecular events. Today we tend to accord the status of mystery to something that should be as intimately familiar as life, and that is consciousness. If there is a lesson here, it has to do with humility. For all our vaunted intelligence and complexity, we are not the sole authors of our destinies or of anything else. You may exercise diligently, eat a medically fashionable diet, and still die of a sting from an irritated bee. You may be a slim, toned paragon of wellness, and still a macrophage within your body may decide to throw in its lot with an incipient tumor. Ely Metchnikoff understood this as well as any biologist since his time ever has. Rejecting the traditional and continuing themes of harmony and wholeness, he posited a biology based on conflict within the body and carried on by the body's own cells as they compete for space and food and oxygen. We may influence the outcome of these conflicts through our personal habits and perhaps eventually through medical technologies that will persuade immune cells to act in more responsible ways, but we cannot control it, and we certainly cannot forestall its inevitable outcome, which is death. Chapter 10. Successful Aging. The pressure to remain fit, slim, and in control of one's body does not end with old age. In fact, it only grows more insistent. Friends, family members, and doctors start nagging the aging person to join a gym, eat healthy, or at the very least, go for daily walks. You may have imagined a reclining chair or a hammock awaiting you after decades of stress, and in the case of manual laborers, physical exertion. But no, your future more likely holds a treadmill and a lat pull, at least if you can afford to access these devices. One of the bossier self-help books for seniors commands, "Exercise 6 days a week for the rest of your life. Sorry, but that's it. No negotiations, no give, no excuses. 6 days, serious exercise, until you die." The reason for this draconian regime is that once you pass the age of 50, exercise is no longer optional. You have to exercise or get old. You may have retired from paid work, but you have a new job, going to the gym. Think of it as a great job, which it is. People over 55 are now the fastest-growing demographic for gym membership. A few gyms, like the Silver Sneakers chain, deliberately target the elderly, in some cases even to the point of discouraging those who are younger, on the theory that older folks don't want to be intimidated by meatballs or spandex sylphs. If the mere presence of white-haired gym-goers isn't enough to repel the young, some gyms don't offer free weights, partly because the sound of falling weights is supposedly annoying to older people, and partly because older people, who are more likely to use exercise machines, may see them as a reproach. In the mixed-age gym I go to, membership tilts toward the over-50 crowd, where exercise is no longer optional. The more dedicated may use the gym as only part of their fitness regimen. They run in the morning or bike several miles to get there. Mark, a 58-year-old white-collar worker, does a 6 a.m. workout before going to work, then another one after work. His goal? To keep going. The price of survival is endless toil. For an exemplar of healthy aging, we are often referred to Jean-Louise Calment, a French woman who died in 1997 at the age of 122, the longest confirmed human lifespan. Calment never worked in her life, but it could be said she worked out. While he was still alive, she and her wealthy husband enjoyed tennis, swimming, fencing, hunting, and mountaineering. She took up fencing when she was 85, and even at 111, when she was in a nursing home, started the morning with gymnastics performed in her wheelchair. Anyone looking for dietary tips will be disappointed. She liked beef, fried foods, chocolates, and pound cake. Unthinkably, by today's standards, she smoked cigarettes and sometimes cigars, though anti-smoking advocates should be relieved to know that she suffered from a persistent cough in her final years. This is successful aging, which, except for the huge investment of time it can require, is almost indistinguishable from not aging at all. Anthropologist Sarah Lamb and her co-authors of a book on the subject date the concept of successful aging to the 1980s and locate it throughout the Western world, where it also goes by such names as active aging, healthy aging, productive aging, vital aging, anti-aging, and aging well. Lamb reports that the World Health Organization dedicated World Health Day 2012 to healthy aging, and the European Union designated 2012 as the European Year for Active Aging. In North America and Western Europe, Centers for Healthy Aging, Active Aging, and Successful Aging abound. Popular cultural and self-help books on the topic are flourishing. Among the titles now available on Amazon are Successful and Healthy Aging, 101 Best Ways to Feel Younger and Live Longer. Live Long, Die Short, A Guide to Authentic Health and Successful Aging. Do Not Go Gentle, Successful Aging for Baby Boomers and All Generations. Aging Backwards, Reverse the Aging Process and Look 10 Years Younger in 30 Minutes a Day. And of course, Healthy Aging for Dummies. A major theme is that aging itself is abnormal and unacceptable. As the physician co-author of Younger Next Year wrote under the subhead, Normal Aging Isn't Normal. The more I looked at the science, the more it became clear to me that such ailments and deterioration, heart attacks, strokes, the common cancers, diabetes, most falls, fractures, are not a normal part of growing old. They are an outrage. And who is responsible for this outrage? Well, each of us is individually responsible. All of the books in the successful aging literature insist that a long and healthy life is within the reach of anyone who will submit to the required discipline. It's up to you and you alone, never mind what scars from overexertion, genetic defects, or poverty may be left from your prior existence. Nor is there much or any concern for the material factors that influence the health of an older person, such as personal wealth or access to transportation and social support. Except for your fitness trainer or successful aging guru, you're on your own. Unfortunately, the guru's instructions are far from unanimous or easy to follow. On the dietary front, there's no more clarity than can be found in the general dietary advice for adults. Should you go with a paleo diet or one heavy in complex carbohydrates? Should you eliminate all fats that do not originate in avocados or olives? We are widely advised to follow a Mediterranean diet, but does that include Greek gyros and Italian charcuterie? Or perhaps we should refrain from eating anything at all. Numerous studies have shown that caloric restriction or intermittent fasting can prolong the lives of rats and other animals, but the debate over its effectiveness in humans goes on, despite the fact that most of us would find a semi-starved life not worth living. If I can discern a general rule, it is governed by deprivation. Anything you like to eat, because it is, for example, fatty, salty, or sweet, should probably be put aside now in the interests of successful aging. As for exercise, here too we find no precise instructions. Some sources, like the book quoted earlier, specify the rough amount of exercise, such as 6 days a week for about 45 minutes per session, and how it should be divided between cardiovascular work and muscle training. But overall, a disturbing vagueness prevails. Often we are urged simply to get active or get moving, on the grounds that even the smallest motion can be life-prolonging. And even if you can't run a 4-minute mile, keep running. If you can't run, walk, but keep moving. For the sedentary, fidgeting at one's desk can help, along with parking a block or so from one's destination. A middle-aged woman reports that, "I keep maniacally active because if there's any downtime, I sit there feeling guilty I'm not doing anything." Not doing anything is the same as aging. Health and longevity must be earned through constant activity. Even the tremors of Parkinson's disease can be seen, optimistically, as a form of health-giving exercise, since they do, after all, burn calories. The one thing you should not be doing is sitting around and, say, reading a book about healthy aging. There are bright sides to aging, such as declines in ambition, competitiveness, and lust. In her 70s, Betty Friedan turned her attention from gender to aging, writing a book called The Fountain of Aging, and telling an interviewer that as they age, people become more and more authentically themselves. They didn't care anymore what other people thought of them, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and, am I going to make a fool of myself? Another noted feminist, the Australian-born Englishwoman Lynn Siegel, found artists often doing their best work in old age, and titled her balanced and richly documented book, Out of Time, The Pleasures and Perils of Aging. I can add from my own experience that aging also comes along with a refreshing refusal to strive, to take on every potential obligation and opportunity that comes my way. But as even the most ebullient of the elderly eventually comes to realize aging is above all an accumulation of disabilities, often beginning well before Medicare eligibility or the arrival of the first Social Security check. Vision loss typically begins in one's 40s, bringing the need for reading glasses. Menopause strikes in a woman's early 50s, along with the hollowing out of bones. Knee and lower back pain arise in the 40s and 50s, compromising the mobility required for successful aging. As we older people mutter to each other in the gym, it's just one damn thing after another. Most of these things are too commonplace and boring even to serve as small talk. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that nearly 40% of people age 65 and older suffer from at least one disability, with two-thirds of them saying they have difficulty walking or climbing. Yet we soldier along, making occasional concessions to arthritic joints or torn muscles, but always aware that any major cessation of effort, say for 2 weeks or more, could lead to catastrophic collapse. You don't become inactive because you age, we've been told over and over. You age because you've become inactive. No doubt immortality would be a more alluring goal if we could imagine surviving without disability, but hardly anyone, outside of the narrow demographic slice represented by Silicon Valley billionaires, is interested in an extended life of being fed and toileted by caretakers until the next biomedical breakthrough comes along. More modestly, the goal of successful aging is often described as a compression of morbidity into one's last few years. In other words, a healthy, active life followed by a swift descent into death. The latter goal may help account for the rise of extreme and dangerous sports in recent years, at least among those who can afford ski resorts, snowboarding, or a trip to Nepal. While the poor are chided for unhealthy lifestyles, the rich are applauded for summiting Everest, an enterprise with a 6.5% mortality rate and costing a minimum of about $100,000, not counting equipment or airfare. Although fitness enthusiasts will be happy to know that both gluten-free and vegan diets are now available to climbers. But the goals of a healthy, active life followed by a fairly quick death may not even be compatible without the intervention of avalanches and altitude sickness. The truly sinister possibility is that for many of us, all the little measures we take to remain fit, all the deprivations and exertions, will only lead to a longer chance to live with crippling and humiliating disabilities. As a New York Times columnist observed, the price we're paying for extended lifespans is a high rate of late-life disability. There are no guarantees. But where there are no guarantees, there are plenty of promises, of which younger next year is far from the most extravagant. Skincare products, once content to be age-defying, are increasingly claimed to be age-reversing. And we are told by the wellness coaches and websites, a youthful appearance is part of feeling good about yourself, which is deemed essential to wellness at any chronological age. Credit for adding beauty, or at least a simulacrum of youthfulness, to the wellness package should go to the new celebrity wellness entrepreneurs, starting with actor Gwyneth Paltrow, whose digital company Goop has been dispensing tips on beauty, health, recipes, and shopping since 2008. Actor Blake Lively launched her own lifestyle company in 2013, which is about living a very one-of-a-kind curated life, and included home decorating tips. The general assumption is that the customers have plenty of time and money on their hands for, among many other things, a $60 skin rejuvenating pillowcase with patented copper technology, or a $5,000 radio frequency skin tightening treatment. If you have enough money for such gadgets and interventions, you can presumably buy your way out of the strenuous younger next year approach to aging and take a more sybaritic path, one designed not to challenge but to pamper. The celebrity wellness entrepreneur du jour, Amanda Bacon, who is a celebrity only by virtue of her Moon Juice wellness products, offers, instead of exercise regimens, a line of ointments and drinks, heavy on the kinds of exotic and expensive substances that Bacon herself likes to consume. Hoshu Wu, Silver Needle Tea, Pearl, Reishi, Cordyceps, Quinsen Shots, Bee Pollen, and Chaga. The theme here is self-nurturance, as reflected in the cost of the items consumed, as well as the time that goes into curating and procuring them. As New York Times reporter Molly Young comments, "What Goop and acolytes like Moon Juice sell is the notion that it's not only excusable but worthy for a person to spend hours a day focused on her tiniest mood shifts, food choices, beauty rituals, exercise habits, bathing routines, and sleep schedule. What they sell is self-absorption as the ultimate luxury product." Not surprisingly, these celebrity-endorsed wellness techniques are not exactly evidence-based, although, of course, there may be some large-scale, double-blind, randomized studies of, say, the salubrious effects of pearl consumption that I am not aware of. But there are other equally passive and sweat-free wellness techniques that claim slightly more scientific credibility, such as touch therapy. It is known that human infants, and probably those of many other mammals, only thrive when held and touched. Extrapolating from that, some wellness purveyors surmise that even adults in modern societies suffer from touch deprivation, most of all the elderly ones, who may have lost, or lost interest in, their partners and simply aged out of the dating pool. Fortunately, touch is easy enough to commoditize in the form of massages or healing touch therapies that can be offered by spas, hospitals, and senior care centers. An assisted living center excitedly tells us that touch reduces blood pressure and glucose and increases alertness, while all-out hugs strengthen the immune system, relieve pain and depression, elevate mood, reduce stress, decrease the heart rate, and may prevent Parkinson's disease. The hugs can be dispensed by care providers or acquired from the fledgling cuddling industry, which offers asexual cuddles for a price. Inflammaging. In the 20th century, medical science began to think of aging as a kind of disease, as opposed to a normal stage of the life cycle. Women were used to having their lives medicalized from puberty to menopause, with pregnancy and childbirth as acute episodes requiring intense medical monitoring and often intervention. But since there was no cure for aging, the elderly were pretty much left to their own devices, once meaning tonics and elixirs rich in alcohol or cocaine, which may have been, at least in the short term, highly effective. Not until the 1960s and 70s did a researcher come up with a theory of aging at the subcellular level, which in the reductionist biology of the time was the only level that counted as interesting. This was the telomere theory. Every time a cell divides, the tips of its chromosomes, telomeres, grow shorter until further cell divisions become impossible. The theory had its problems. Many types of cells, such as cardiac cells and neurons, do not reproduce or do not do so very often, yet they somehow manage to age. but it also presented a tempting commercial opportunity in the form of drugs that might lengthen and fortify telomeres. Although their pharmaceutical promise has not been fulfilled, a host of other chemical agents in the aging process have been identified, each with its own proposed nostrum. Free radicals were popular culprits in the 1980s and 90s, leading to a brief fad of consuming antioxidants like vitamin E and selenium, to no effect, as it turned out. Methylation, the addition of a methyl group to a protein or nucleic acid, is required for cellular health and is thought to be encouraged by B vitamins such as folate. But the effect of B vitamins on aging is murky at best. Or, it has been proposed, mutations can occur in a cell's DNA, leading to accumulated intracellular damage, and there is no known cure for that. All of these proposed chemical pathways of aging occur within individual cells, and all are suggestive of the kind of deep trends one might associate with aging, decay and entropy. The analogy is often made to the kind of wear and tear that eventually disables a machine, or at least its moving parts, except that cells are not machines, and their moving parts are molecules or clusters of molecules that are subject to perpetual destruction and renewal. Proteins, the fundamental chemical ingredient of cells, are constantly being torn apart by intracellular digestive enzymes and replaced by freshly constructed ones. Some of the key protein players in cellular metabolism have half-lives only minutes long, meaning that there are plenty of opportunities for errors, as well as opportunities for correcting them. Over time, though, with advancing age, the errors accumulate until the integrity of the cell is compromised, and it is then that things get interesting. Damaged cells attract immune cells, or more precisely, damaged cells send out chemical signals that attract the immune cells, which proceed to devour the ailing cells. Some of the immune cells are messy eaters, leaving behind debris or the equivalent of crumbs, which in turn attracts more immune cells. Macrophages in particular are drawn to damaged cells. In fact, their chief function in the body, in addition to fighting microbes, is the removal of such compromised cells. Thus, the site of cell damage becomes a site of inflammation, where macrophages pile up and attract more macrophages to share in the meal. Inflammation is, of course, life-saving when provoked by microbes, but when the target is the body's own cells or damaged versions thereof, it can lead, however gradually, to death. In 2000, the Italian immunologist Claudio Franceschi proposed the neologism inflammaging to describe the entire organism-wide process of aging. Far from being a simple process of decay originating in individual cells, aging involves the active mobilization of macrophages to deal with proliferating sites of cellular damage. Today, Franceschi's theory is widely accepted, with inflammaging being described, ominously enough, as chronic smoldering oxidative and inflammatory stress. The hallmark disorders of aging, such as atherosclerosis, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, and osteoporosis, are all inflammatory diseases characterized by a local buildup of macrophages. In atherosclerosis, for example, macrophages settle in the arteries leading to the heart, where they gorge themselves with lipids until the arteries are eventually blocked. In type 2 diabetes, macrophages accumulate in the pancreas, where they destroy the cells that produce insulin. Osteoporosis involves the activation of bone-dwelling macrophages, called osteocytes, that kill normal bone cells. The inflammation associated with Alzheimer's disease was first thought to represent macrophages' attempts to control the beta-amyloid plaques that clog up the Alzheimer's brain. But the most recent research suggests that the macrophages, which may indeed be activated by the plaques, actually drive the progression of the disease. These are not degenerative diseases, not just accumulations of errors and cobwebs. They are active and seemingly purposeful attacks by the immune system on the body itself. Why should this happen? Perhaps a better question is, why shouldn't it happen? The survival of an older person is of no evolutionary consequence, since that person can no longer reproduce, unless one wants to argue for the role of grandparents in prolonging the lives of their descendants. It might even, in a Darwinian sense, be better to remove the elderly before they can use up any more resources that might otherwise go to the young. In that case, you could say that there is something almost altruistic about the diseases of aging. Just as programmed cell death, apoptosis, cleanly eliminates damaged cells from the body, so do the diseases of aging clear up the clutter of biologically useless older people, only not quite so cleanly. And this perspective may be particularly attractive at a time, like now, when the dominant discourse on aging focuses on the deleterious economic effects of largely aging populations. If we didn't have inflammatory diseases to get the job done, we might have to turn to euthanasia. But however benevolent the diseases of aging might ultimately be, at least from a social or economic perspective, they are experienced by the individual as a betrayal. In one of his last novels, Everyman, Philip Roth's protagonist, who is essentially the same Roth-like, sex-obsessed character who has starred in most of his novels, must face his own physical deterioration. Well into his 70s, retired and largely estranged from his family, he is still hitting on women at least a half-century younger than himself. Mostly, though, he is aging, tormented by his increasingly unreliable penis and by atherosclerosis, which comes to require heart surgery every year. The setting is increasingly claustrophobic as it moves among waiting rooms and hospitals before returning to the cemetery where the story started, at a family funeral, and where his own body will eventually rest. It is unlikely that Roth knew anything about inflammaging or the cellular basis of atherosclerosis, but he accurately summed up the biological situation when he wrote that old age isn't a battle, old age is a massacre. So whatever good deeds immune cells may accomplish in the young, such as fending off microbial infections, their job, or perhaps we should say their effect in the elderly, is to destroy the organism. The question of why they do these things might be simplified into a more childish form. Are the immune cells good, or are they bad? Friends or foes? For the most part, scientists dodge this question with mumblings about paradoxical effects or a double-edged sword. Macrophages can save our lives or promote deadly tumors. Neutrophils, which are among the first immune cells to arrive at a site of infection, can slay intruders or start a spiral into chronic inflammation. Scientists sometimes fall back on the language of moral judgment, of good and bad. For example, a researcher who has contributed to several papers on inflammation attempts to exonerate neutrophils by blaming their occasional bad behavior on other cell types they are in contact with, which are typically other immune cells. Although neutrophils may often appear to be the bad guy in certain inflammatory conditions, this is typically due to the influence of other molecules released from surrounding cells. Without this influence, the primary aim of the neutrophil is to resolve inflammation, making them overall the good guys of the inflammatory process. It would take a lengthy trial to determine the guilt or innocence of the immune system or of any cell type within it. In the case of macrophages, their contributions to the well-being of the organism are well known. They help sculpt the embryo into a human fetus. They defend the body against microbial invasions. They participate in the process of antigen presentation. They keep the body clear of dead and damaged cells. On the destructive side, they encourage the growth and spread of tumors. They launch the catastrophe of inflammaging. They are frontline killers in autoimmune diseases. If I were a prosecutor in the trial of macrophages, I might wind up my case with the autoimmune diseases, which may not prove active malice on the macrophages' part, but certainly make a case for homicidal negligence. In their defense, macrophages could argue that whatever the deleterious consequences, they are simply doing the kind of things they are expected to do. Removing damaged cells, for example. To which the prosecution might counter that macrophages have way too much discretion in determining which cells are damaged enough to die, and may even have caused the initial harm themselves. Early in his massive work on the history and philosophy of immunology, The Immune Self, Theory or Metaphor, Alfred Tauber states that the immune self has come to be viewed analogously to a living entity. His use of the passive voice conceals who has come to see the immune self in this way, he himself or immunologists in general. But the larger question is, what does it mean to say that some part or parts of the body act as a living entity? Certainly the cells of the immune system are in constant communication and are capable of rather dramatic forms of cooperation. For example, if a macrophage needs to expand its supply of cell-killing digestive enzymes, all it has to do is gobble up a neutrophil and add the neutrophil's stockpile of enzymes to its own. So the immune system seems to qualify as a system. But does it possess the autonomy we expect to find in a living entity? If so, we should probably call the nervous system a kind of living entity too, since it is capable of plotting and carrying out the death of the organism, in the form of suicide by gunshot or poison, on its own. But what kind of an entity is it? Is it a second, shadow self, assuming the word self has not been so degraded by its metaphorical uses as to be meaningless? The best analogy I can come up with would be that it is a symbiont, living in a symbiotic relationship within us, sometimes saving our lives and sometimes destroying us. All we can say for sure is that its agenda does not always concur with ours, and there does not seem to be any command and control center within the organism to bring these agendas reliably into harmony. There are many small measures, to be sure, checks and balances, anti- and pro-inflammatory chemical messages, but there is ultimately no one in charge. The danger is that the inflammatory forays of the immune system can easily tilt into lethal cascades. A plaque composed of macrophages can suddenly block a coronary artery. Alzheimer's disease, which is an inflammatory disease of the brain, can cut off the neuronal circuits controlling breathing. Where there is an inflammation, body cells are damaged, and the damage lures more inflammatory cells to the site. Macrophages get less efficient with age, slower and less effective as phagocytes and defenders against microbial invasions. But the effect may be to make them even messier eaters than they were in their youth, and hence more prone to inadvertently call for more macrophages as backup. Chronic, smoldering inflammations can easily ignite into conflagrations. We all know how this ends, though for the most part we prefer not to think about it. When the organism dies, as signaled by the cessation of the heartbeat and respiration, not all body cells die simultaneously,